love Might Delete Later.
I bloody hope you do. You can support our show by using the new Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there is no regular commitment.
Just smash that link in the show description and support us now so we can keep making this podcast.
Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Might Delete Later with me, Stevie Martin, a person who feels social media is the bad guy in the movie of life that you really want to see overthrown or killed off.
And me, Jeannie Martin, who is Stevie's little sister and who feels it's actually the protagonist and the script just hasn't been written right.
Our guest today is a French-Moroccan political journalist who used to be the Evening Standard's political diarist and BuzzFeed's media political correspondent before she went freelance and then just worked for literally everyone from like Al Jazeera to The Mirror to just any newspaper you've ever heard of, she's written for it.
She's written a lot of words. She's also written the book Haven't You Heard? Gossip's Politics and Power, which is all about the importance of gossip and rumours in politics and how that's central to it. And it makes politics really accessible and funny for people, and I've just bought it.
It's a lovely episode. We talk about, Tumblr for the first time.
Which we'd completely forgotten about.
She's probably the person who's been at the other end of one of the biggest Twitter pylons and sort of when Twitter turns against you that I've ever really seen. And she talks about that as well and is very, very eloquent and very, very balanced.
Also, like, really liked how we chatted about deleting tweets, because deleting tweets is often seen as kind of a sin in the social media world, even though this entire podcast called Might Delete Later. But it wasn't deleting tweets as in when you've tweeted them, it was going back to your history and backlog and wondering, is it really great for me to have these 18-year-old tweets on here when I'm a journalist? So I found that the way she is empowered and, like, just does what she wants with her own platform quite cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool episode.
So before we get to our guest, what is in your social media drafts this week, Steve Oyd Martoin?
I hate TikTok. I'm really sorry. I tried to like it. I like it academically. So I'm like, oh, fun, dancing. I've only been on it like properly twice. I've been on it and then I've like been like, oh, 7 hours has gone by. And I don't need that in my life. Like, I don't need something else.
You don't need another scroll hole. No, that's true.
Exactly.
Another platform of guilt.
Exactly.
That is not needed in your life. TikTok is not your priority and I don't want it to be.
What's in your drafts?
I went viral on TikTok.
Wow, fuck off.
I'm sorry. I was posting vitamin P and stuff, and then I did that kind of story on Instagram about dressing how you want to dress, which we've already talked about, in an environment that wants you to assimilate into like a male archetype of power. I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll speak really, because I talk very, very fast, and I've been told my whole life to slow down, and I never have. And I thought, yeah, I'll just go real fast and do this mad little, hey, you know what? And just do the whole conversation I did on Instagram, but just try and do it in like 15 seconds. And I just did that on TikTok just to see. And it just went viral, and it's got like, I don't know, half a million views, some shit. And
what?
I realized that, hey, look, this is actually probably a good platform because there's a lot of young people on here that aren't having these conversations. And like when you know, I'm not Gen Z and I'm engaging in Instagram, Twitter, which they're probably like see as like LinkedIn now.
Yeah,
so it's like, well, why don't I just do these 50 seconds really fast? Like, hey, have you ever thought about blah, 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 blah? And I'm just educating on the upskilling law. That's all I'm doing. But there's loads of kids on there. So hopefully that'll be good for educating some young people on their rights around their body.
Well done.
Thank you.
Firstly, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Marie.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are very much an interesting social media person that I have thought I wanted to get on for quite a while. We normally start by sort of deciding things that we would like to delete in the week. I feel just for like to set the bar, I'll go first because mine's incredibly low and lame. I would like to delete foundations that don't have SPF in them, because then you have to put sun cream on underneath, which is like a thing that I like to wear SPF, and my foundation got discontinued. So my fave, it got cancelled. It was just fuck your foundation. That was my one. I've used it for years. Now to find a new skin, that's hard. And it doesn't, the one I found is excellent, doesn't have SPF in it.
So is like a thing that keeps coming up with you, is that remember when we had that conversation about wearing SPF and I said, yeah, you have to put it on every day, even if it's not sunny. And you were like, really quietly, you were like, what?
Yes.
And this was like 2 years ago.
Yes.
She was like, oh, so I haven't even been doing that right. And you got really upset about it.
I was really upset. I was like, well, no one told me that. So I'd like to delete all foundations without SPF. And so then the only options help you protect your face against the skin. What, son?
That's a good one. I'm deleting ethical deodorants because me and Geordie have... Well, okay, maybe not all ethical deodorants, but maybe ethical deodorants that are rubbish, which is most of them, because me and Geordie, my partner, have been trying to find one, and we've bought, like, I don't know, probably spent, like, £50 on, like, over a period of months. And I just ended up with, like, lots of, like...
BO.
Lots of bars of just like nice smelling wax. And then you put it on your armpits and it's like, well, I've just got waxy armpits that smell like kefir lime leaves or whatever, but only for about 4 minutes. And then I just smell like gross again. And they just don't work. I just don't believe in them. I don't think the technology's there yet. And I want a formula that blocks my armpits from sweating.
Yes, good. Marie, what would you like to delete? And is it beauty related?
I think now you've inspired me, because actually you reminded me of one of my biggest pet peeves. No, which is okay, right. Why do beauty brands just cancel their, like, you know, discontinue their products all the time? And I feel like such an old lady complaining about this. But I swear that, you know, I'll find like an eyebrow pencil and be like, yes, it suits me, it works great. And then go back to buy it again like 4 months later and it stopped and it's all very confusing and there's new ones. And I hate that. So there you go. So I think, you know, I'm actually building up on your foundation thing. I think just stop. You know, products are good. There's no need for new products all the time. Life is complicated. I'm very tired. I don't always go like, like, you know, what? Yeah.
Like with mascaras, they had like, they went through that period of time. I don't know if they still have it now, where there's like one side is white and the other side is black. And you put the white on first. And you put the black. It was like a very French thing that apparently everyone.
Not French. That is not French. On behalf of France, nationally, I would like to say that one is not on us. Many things are on us.
Good to know.
And actually, you just brought up something that is quite. Is there a difference between French Twitter and UK Twitter? Because obviously, I wouldn't know because I don't speak it. But you are multilingual.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure I really follow enough people on French Twitter to really know that, because I only kind of follow like a few French political journalists and journalists in general and like my actual friends, but that's it. So I'm not sure. I'd say there's definitely a lot less chatting about class, I would say. Like, that is not a thing that France does, which is so nice. It's so nice, you know, to just be able to tweet and not have someone say, well, you know, sounds like someone's very middle class. And it's like, no, I don't, you know, I was tweeting about, please don't. French media Twitter, above all, enjoys talking about French media Twitter. And that's nice, because, you know, that's not written, you know, journalists everywhere just really enjoy talking about each other and about themselves and about journalism. But yeah, apart from that, it's quite similar, I think.
The class thing is quite interesting, because that is something that you cannot move on Twitter for. That, like, I'm to the extent where, you know, often I get worried that I think I'm the wrong one and I have to, I've looked it up and like,
you know. I've done the online test of like, what class are you, because I'm like, I'm a foreigner, I'm not actually sure. Like, I thought it was quite straightforward, but it turns out there's so many different markers. Yeah, and no, I agree. Like, I've been like, am I lying, very confusing. But also, again, you never know what you're gonna say, and then it's just gonna be like, it's now about class, like, surprise. I hate that.
Yeah. That is the baseline, isn't it? Class is the baseline. So it seems to always come back to that almost.
Yeah, I find it interesting when someone does very well because of like a creative pursuit or something. Like, I don't know, it's a great TV show, great. And you just know that immediately, and I do it sometimes, but the first thing that most people are doing are like on their Wikipedia page, like, how rich are their parents? Like, can we be like, oh, well, that's why it's so good. Which obviously there's a big class divide in the arts, but it is funny how much it like immediately happens. You're like, okay, so we're supposed to cancel that person because they were born to a rich family.
It used to be like in the 90s and noughties, it was like, I remember everyone was like,
with a celebrity or someone in the public eye, it was like, how much do they weigh? Which was like the most Googled thing, which was really problematic and not cool. But now it seems to be like, where did they go to school? Just for people who obviously know you now and all the work you've done, you've written for almost every platform, pretty much, and you've published a really successful book as well. So how did you get into journalism and where were you before? And tell us a bit about how you got into the job you're into in now and why you're so well known.
Oh, I think I'm going to do a slightly longer story, but I think because it's sort of relevant to the theme of this podcast, I guess, given that it's about the internet and everything. But so when I was 15, I really loved like indie music and stuff like that, you know, so like boys in bands with guitars and so on. And I really wanted to launch, because my whole thing was that obviously Britain had, you know, the NME obviously, and had lots and lots of different blogs, but France didn't really have any. So it had clearly like a demand, like those bands were quite successful in France, but didn't really have media catering to them. And so with the, you know, sort of like typical bravado of a 15-year-old, I was like, well, you know, and here I come. So I will launch a website, which I deeply embarrassingly called MD Amazing, despite obviously never having done MDMA because I was fucking 15. But yeah, but I thought it was cool. I mean, obviously terrible as well because French people didn't know what that meant or how to pronounce it. So I just have to deal with people who are like, MD Amazing, which is mortifying. But yeah, no, so I did that, and actually, in a sort of, not to brag, but I think really my bet was the right one, and that the website ended up being quite successful. And so by the time I was 17, that we had a team, so like between France and Belgium and Switzerland, and covered lots of gigs and lots of like different things, interviewed lots of bands, etc. So I kind of did that. Actually, MD Amazing for a short amount of time had a Wikipedia page, not created by us, and which was deleted after a month.
That's an amazing hallmark. Make it yourself, that's great.
It was, however, it was deleted after like 3 weeks for being not relevant. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. but yeah, so I kind of did that, and that kind of, I guess, got me into journalism. And also, obviously, helped me practice my English, because I interviewed quite a lot of bands, and that's basically a better way to learn English than just learning it at school. And yeah, so I kind of ended up in Britain and then studied journalism because that was kind of like my thing. And then so no, I think I actually joined Twitter in 2010, 2011, during the student protest. God, you've got the data.
We checked, yeah.
But yeah, in 2011, like, during the student protest, because obviously, you know, these were the first sort of like proper, like big social media protests. And like, if you're part of the movement, you know, it was kind of the done thing to have a Twitter account and you sort of like live tweet the protests you went on and where the police was, etc. So kind of, yeah, creating an account for that. But then I actually really enjoyed it because I'd always enjoyed social media anyway. And then, yeah, so graduated in 2013 and then worked at a bunch of places, including The Mirror and The Telegraph, etc. Then ended up at the Evening Standard Diary in 2015, which is a sort of like gossipy column, and ended up kind of doing politics there. So I became the political diarist of the Evening Standard, did that for a while, had a lot of fun. Then was the BuzzFeed politics and media correspondent for a bit. That was less fun. And so I left that just over 3 years ago and went freelance, and now I write features about politics as a freelancer, and I do, I do stuff. It's a weird thing about being freelancer. I do things. People pay me and I do things. I provide services.
You make politics quite accessible, I think, as well, because you're really, apparently, I haven't read your book. I actually just ordered it this morning when me and Steve were talking about it. I was reading about it, but it seems like it's really funny and there's like humour in it, and it's made it accessible because I think a lot of people are intimidated by politics. And to have someone like you who's talking about it in a way that feels accessible, it's almost like, you know, you have the word gossip in the title of your book and it's like it feels like you can get into it a bit more because a lot of stuff is quite dry and quite intimidating. Mm. So I feel like that's very like valuable.
Especially on Twitter as well. That is something that you do very, very well because you sort of tweet very like incisive political commentary amid fun stuff.
Yeah, it's relatable and accessible.
It's probably partly because I didn't study politics. The reason I got into politics, which is a very long story I've told many times, but I can do the short version of it, which was that when I was 18 and it was the end of the first year of my degree, I went to the gig of a band where I fancied like one of the guys. And then after the gig, he was just like, hey, we're having an after party at my house. You should come. And I was like, oh my God, it's finally going to happen. I'm finally going to get with that guy. And so we went to his house. And then the second we got there, he started hitting on someone else, which was very awkward for me because I didn't know anyone there. But also out of weird stubbornness, I was like, I'm not leaving. I'm here now. You never know what may happen. And turns out it was the night of the 2010 election, which was on the telly in the corner for some reason, because occasionally the telly is on at house parties and you never know why. And yeah, and so I just sat down with a bottle of wine and watched the election out of social awkwardness and just found it really fun. And that was kind of that. I just am slightly ashamed to admit this, but I'm actually not at all. But a lot of what I know about political history is basically that I fell into a rabbit hole of like politics Tumblr, which was a big thing in around sort of like 2014, 2015. It was called Lolitics, which was very old internet now. And basically, a lot of what I know is just having had to like try and reverse engineer memes of being like, I don't know who that person is or why that's funny. So try and Google and be like, oh, Neil Kinnock. Right, got it. But yeah, so basically I think like, because my, you know, what I know about politics, I did not learn in a normal, dull way. So I can really talk about it like that, I think, because that's not how I learned it.
That makes a lot of sense.
I can't believe this. That's the first time we've talked about Tumblr on this podcast.
The best website, the best website.
It's so, so great. Just a lot of Tom Hiddleston would often crop up. When I was a celebrity journalist, I'd have to find something funny. I'd be like, I guess I'll just search Tom Hiddleston on Tumblr and something funny will like come up, because he was so prevalent on there. But I would see how like the memes and stuff like that, like how that, it was so much more, what's the word, community-based than I was using it in like 2013. I would just be like, dear diary. And I'd like do a diary entry and then leave Tumblr and be like, very good. Like, no one was reading it.
And there's a whole, like, culture on there, and it felt like a nice culture as well. I mean, Taylor Swift still uses it, like, prolifically now. Ooh. And that's part of her huge fandom base, is that she's created this community that's, like, people aren't using it there, really, and she's still got that massive Tumblr community base.
I had no idea that it had a politics, but Lolitics is just brilliant.
It was great. So it was a weird mix of, like, so I had a slightly fraught relationship with the Lolitics fandom. Because some of it, I'm sorry, like, you know, because part of it, I was like, you know, I'm genuinely enjoying this. This is interesting and funny. But other stuff was like, come on. Like, there was a massive George Osborne fandom for a while. It's just a bunch of weird teenagers who were extremely horny for George Osborne.
So it was like the Ed Miliband thing, where everyone, did that come from Tumblr? Like, Miliband.
But that was the vibe. So, like, the mini fandom, like, in terms of vibe, like, that very much came from the Tumblr thing of, like, the photoshopping flower crowns on politicians and stuff. Like, that didn't really start with the mini fandom. That was already something that existed on Tumblr. And I remember, like, one of the ones that haunted me the most, I think, and to this day still, was a picture of Andy Burnham. I want to say there was a flower crown and, like, slightly, like, kawaii eyes, because, you know, he's got very long eyelashes. And the caption was, you know, written in sort of like pink, gloopy, like glittery thing, was like, my eyelashes are longer than your dick.
Oh,
I saw that in like 2014, and I'm still just like, I'm not okay, fundamentally not okay.
Oh my God.
But yeah, so that is basically how I got.
I don't think people understand this stuff's happening.
It's like kids in a playground being like, this, what about this? What about this? What about this? But it's something quite joyful about it.
And like, yeah, and I feel like it teaches you. So I've been on Tumblr for longer than I've been on Twitter or Facebook. So I think I joined Tumblr in 2008. So I'm a Tumblr grandmother, I'm a Tumblr elder. But what I really like about it is I think it sort of teaches you a sort of like quiet acceptance of life. But, you know, you'll read something and be like, you know what, I don't understand it. I don't understand why it's there. I don't get why anyone would write it or what it's about. And that is fine. That is okay.
So every episode, I go back with a little code and I try and find each guest's first ever post, and I literally couldn't find yours.
I delete my tweets.
Marie deletes her tweets. Tell us why.
I think partly is just that, you know, on a very basic level, you know, the reason why I use Twitter now is not the reason why I used Twitter then. So, you know, in 2011, I was with like a student activist, and that was kind of that. And obviously then I became a journalist. And I think obviously while it's entirely fine, I think, for people to have had political opinions while they were at university, while they were young, and to then become an impartial journalist, that obviously that's fine. But also I didn't feel necessarily comfortable with all the opinions I had, you know, as someone who publicly had political opinions, to still be there. So I kind of didn't want them to be there. I think that's partly as well, you know, the general risk of like, could I remember everything I tweeted, you know, when I had sort of like 120 followers and I still had the novelty of being like, ha ha ha, it's 3 a.m. I can tweet whatever I want. Yeah, I didn't want to sort of like be surprised at some point by sort of like Guido Fawkes or whatever being like, and did you see what Marie Lacombe tweeted on like the 1st of February at 2 a.m. in 2012?
Yeah.
Once you reach that sort of weird status of being sort of like popular on Twitter, I suppose, like, you know, being an account that has a certain amount of followers, I think that you do end up tweeting in a way that's very, very different from the way you tweeted when it was just, you know, because at first when I had my account, it was anonymous. And even then, I think for quite a long time, I just had like a bit of a picture, but then only my first name, not my last name. So I do think the platform, you know, your use of the platform is always naturally going to evolve. If you had, say, 500 followers, all of whom were kind of your friends or people who had no idea who you were because you were an anonymous account, to having 70,000 followers with your full name and your picture and your places of work in the bio. You know, in the days of like blogs and the blogosphere, like pre sort of like proper social media, I remember, you know, when we were teens, that like, we always used to change blogs. I changed blogs roughly every sort of like 7 or 8 months because I was like, no, you know, new Marie, new me.
I haven't thought of that in ages. But that is like, it's like, there's such a natural human need, but especially in, I don't know, I would say it goes well into your 20s now, but like especially when you're younger, to find out who you are and play with your identity, and you still change so much how you want to be perceived
and how you express, and
now once you've got your Twitter handle or your TikTok or whatever, you're supposed to just now like stay like that because you've got to build the numbers. So if you change it, then how will you ever grow that clout? And it's so you're supposed to like brand from like 15 onwards, and then you sort of like stick to your brand, and
it's nice to talk to someone who's like, yeah, no, I deleted all the stuff because I wanted it to be this new start and I'm doing this work. And like, it's nice to see someone take ownership of that platform, because actually a lot of conversations with social media, people feel like they don't feel in control of their own platform a lot of the time. They feel like they're at the behest of anyone who may follow them, and they have to appear this way. And to take control of that is actually quite cool, I think.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So let's move on to your worst post. And this is very much the worst post that you have brought. Well, it was a tweet from 2019. I remember you tweeting it. I liked it. And as in, I actually liked it. It was in relation to the documentary Knock Down the House with AOC. And I just watched it and I was like, oh, yeah. And it was just a really, I thought it was a funny use of word. So Marie tweeted, apologies for the blatantly mean tweet, but this is what AOC's boyfriend looks like. Incredible scenes, truly representing all the ambitious and stunning millennial women shackled to boyfriends who look like bin raccoons out there. Now, bin raccoons is one of the greatest phrases that I've personally ever heard. And this was just like a comment on how, you know, AOC has, she's so manicured and she's so like always in a suit and she's so, and her boyfriend is very, it looks like he's just sort of, you know, climbed out of bed and is living life.
You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the Ed Sheeran Beyonce performance conversation.
Yes.
Of like, and AOC talks about it in Knock Down the House at the beginning, and there's that shot of her in front of the mirror and she's saying like, look at all the things I have to do just to show up. And so it felt like a tongue-in-cheek comment on that, but obviously people received it as insulting someone for the way they look, but clearly that it was a broader concept there. Do you want to talk about that?
So I was reviewing the documentary for ID Magazine, and so I was watching it one like Wednesday, I think, when you were like weekday morning, which as a side note was great because I was like, I can't believe I'm in bed watching Netflix for work. Like, I feel like, you know, I've won at life.
Best.
you know, is that quite a funny thing when you watch the documentary? Because she is so, you know, she's not so, AOC is not just beautiful. She's also, you know, she dresses incredibly well. Her hair is incredible. Her makeup is always on point. She's got the gold hoops, etc. So you're going to follow her around. And then it was just, yeah, that the shot pans out at some point. And then there's this man with this sort of like fucking like bush beard and like t-shirt that's, if I remember correctly, some like offensive shade of purple. But, you know, one of those T-shirts you probably got for free somewhere. You know, the T-shirt woman would be like, fine, I can use it for pyjamas. And men are like, yes, this is my T-shirt now. I will wear it every day. And yeah, and I just, you know, just tweeted it, didn't think of it. And actually, weirdly, I think tweeted it. And a few people were like, oh, that's a bit mean. And I was like, yeah, it is, you know, and sort of moved on. But I think what was interesting about it was that it only really exploded when the US woke up. So in sort of like early mid-afternoon UK time. But when, you know, and again, I think, you know, that's something that comes back again and again when discussing kind of tweets that go bad viral, when it's clearly like people who had no idea who I was, and so had no idea that, you know, I would never say earnestly something like, you know, a woman is shackled to someone, like, you know, it was like, I was clearly joking. It was clearly meant to, to be read quite lightly. And yeah, and so assumed, I don't know. Yeah, it was just like, you know, it went completely insane.
What was the moment that you realised, like, oh, this is actually quite bad?
Like, I already had my mentions basically on lockdown at the time, so I could only see tweets from people, replies from people who followed me. And so I knew I was getting a bit of traction, but not much. But then I think I actively clicked on the tweet and I saw, like, thousands of replies and I was like, oh, no, oh, no. But then the second thing was my friend Dave, who messaged me and who was like, I don't want to make you panic, but I think we're getting near the bit of the cycle where AOC will clap back. And I was like, oh, no, 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 no. So that's when I panicked and deleted it. A few days later, she posted a video on Instagram of her boyfriend getting his hair cut while someone heckles him Bin Raccoon. And they all laughed. They all laughed. So they clearly found it funny. They found it funny. Again, it means scruffy, it doesn't mean ugly. I think that was the other thing that I meant to say. But, like, a lot of people took it to mean that I was calling her boyfriend ugly. When I was like, no, he's just a scruffy man. She's very polished. He's very scruffy. And I think that's not really an insult. I mean, it's not a mean insult to say, you know, because if anything, the comments were weird. People being like, well, you know, he didn't ask to be born with that face. So that's very mean of you. And it's like, that is not what I said. That is not what I said. You're being the mean one here. But, yeah, so she did that. But then, no, oh, my God. So there, sorry. There was like a big Vogue profile of AOC a few months ago. That's all, you know, was it like 24 hours with or like a week with or whatever. And anyway, and there's a point where I think they do talk about the boyfriend, and there's a line about how the boyfriend's mum keeps trolling him by sending him Bin Raccoon memes.
Stop. You've become part of their life. Like, oh my God, that is so funny. I'm glad that they find it funny and they're enjoying it. If they're fine with it, then why is everyone so het up about it?
You've had like a few kind of, or maybe two, maybe instances of Twitter where you've really felt what Twitter can be like when you have some sort of standing on there and you say something that some people just take out of your hands.
How did I deal with it? Not well, not well. I think I drank quite a lot, but you know, when you sort of like do like stress drinking, I'm just going to wine is fine. Wine helps.
Yes.
So yeah, the healthiest kind of drinking, I like to think. And it was just shit. No, sorry, I feel like I should be, you know, because it happened a while back now, I should be able to say, well, you know, looking back, I have all these deep thoughts. But no, it's just really blowed.
Essentially, I don't know how I would be able to cope with that. And I think you've got a private Twitter account now. Was that in part because of that, to kind of get a bit of control back? Like, how, basically, because you still tweet excellent, good, free tweets on your main account, and I'm always really like, I admire that, because I think I would have run away. And I'm not saying that you should have done at all. I'm saying that, like, I'm just amazed that you kind of got through it.
I think, again, that comes back to the fact that, like, you know, I basically use Twitter for me. I make myself laugh, basically, and obviously it's a nice bonus when people also find me funny, but I just find myself very funny. No, but more seriously, I don't know. I think, you know, I do enjoy, like, I get a bit annoyed at the people who always go on about, you know, the health side and why am I here and it's so depressing, why do you log on, whatever. And it's like, well, you know, if you really do hate it to that extent, surely you can actually stop logging on. Whereas, you know, I think that you know, I'd rather be quite honest about the fact that I actually really enjoy Twitter, you know, but like, you know, in a lot of different ways, you know, in that I've met so many of my friends on there. I've met people I've dated on there. But also, you know, I laugh, you know, I laugh several times a day at dumb tweets. I've learned a lot. I've, you know, had access to so many interesting articles I never would have seen otherwise. Getting back to obviously lockdown, so I spent 3 months, you know, in lockdown by myself as one of the most extroverted people who's ever lived. You know, and obviously I would have, you know, I would have completely lost it without Twitter. And I think, you know, that there was a sense of community to that. But then even, you know, in terms of work, so a lot of the work I found has been through Twitter. I found my agent, my literary agent through Twitter. Like, you know, it's, I would not be where I am, but in so many different areas of life, if it weren't for Twitter, if it hadn't been for Twitter. The other account, it's not, it's a bit of a weird one, because I think I'd had the idea for quite a long time when I wanted, basically wanted to go back to having about 1,000 followers, because I thought that was the sweet spot where people suddenly, like, you know, interact with you. And you're not coming into the void, but also you don't just get, you know, you don't have that thing. Because I think I got to the point with 70,000 followers of, you know, anything I tweeted, I was like, okay, well, you know, what's what was the angle here? What am I going to be attacked on? Like, you know, which random corner of Twitter is going to attack me for this? So, yeah, so I think it got to the point where I was like, there is nothing I can tweet, you know, completely stress-free, because there may always be. So, yeah, so eventually I was like, actually, you know, fuck it. And I still do use my account occasionally. But a lot less. So in terms of the best tweet, I think I actually really struggled to think of like what was like my favorite tweet, because again, I tweet so much. Like, you know, I have tweeted probably like, they're not probably tens of thousands of things over the years. But so I kind of, you know, and also I don't have a memory anymore, because I think the lockdown has broken my brain. So I had to go to quite a recent one. My tweet was, oh God, I can't believe I'm going to have to say it out loud. I'm also quite embarrassed, because it's a weird thing. Like, it's one thing to type it and send it to 75,000 people. It's another to say it out loud to two people. Okay, to be fair to Rishi, it's true that eating out can help mitigate a weak pound.
It's so good.
It's really clever.
So clever. And obviously we're talking about Rishi Sunak, Chancellor of the Exchequer, just so everyone knows.
The reason why I picked that tweet was not just because it's very funny, even though it is. It was that I think that, you know, that's kind of what I enjoy about Twitter. And I think weirdly those two tweets, like the AOC one and that one, exist in the same space, in that I think that what I'm both quite good at and quite bad at on Twitter is just posting stuff that's a bit too much. And I think that's why my Twitter experience became kind of untenable for, like, you know, after a while, because actually when you do end up tweeting stuff that's like a bit too much, occasionally, like the Rishi thing, people will just be like, that was fucking funny, congratulations, I enjoyed this, you know, even though I probably shouldn't have. But like, I had people, like journalists, like lobby journalists, DM me and be like, I obviously can't possibly retweet this, but I laughed a lot. You know, but on the other hand, you know, I can clearly, the problem with that is, you know, I do clearly end up on the wrong side of a bit too much quite often in terms of like jokes or whatever. And yes, it was no longer worth the hassle.
It is an excellent tweet. Also, I was going to ask, anything to do with sex that I ever tweet, I always will get one man called like Jeff, and he has like father of two beautiful daughters in his bio. He has two followers and he goes, hello, dear, in my DMs. And it's a sexual thing. And that could be like, I've even just said the word sex, but I meant it in like a gender way. Like, it could be anything. It just anything. Actually, once we've talked about this on the podcast before, I tweeted a tweet about bread and someone was like, you like bread, do you? Winky face. It's like, right, okay. So when you tweet something about sex and you have like 70 odd thousand followers, do you get people sliding into your DMs? Do you get like...
Yeah, so I think my favourite one of all time in that category was like years ago, actually, but I tweeted, so I think I'd been ill, like I'd had a cold for quite a long time. And I tweeted something along the lines of, wow, just managed to breathe through my nostrils for the first time in 7 days. I swear it was better than about 80% of all the sex I've ever had. Which is, you know, true. It was true. It is also a comment on my ex-boyfriends. But you know, and someone just very earnestly, this man, same, this sort of like middle-aged man, replied incredibly earnestly. He was like, don't despair, little one. It'll happen one day.
Oh,
so I think he genuinely thought I was complaining about not having had, you know, about having had such bad sex that breathing through my nostrils is actually better. And it's like, you ruin everything. No, you just ruin everything.
The tone.
Yeah. But so that's why I didn't really tweet that much about sex kind of for that reason, even though, like, you know, it's a topic I find interesting. And briefly, to come back to Tumblr, I think one of the reasons why I like Tumblr is that it's one of the few places on the internet where sex is just a part of, that is just one of the topics and one of the things that happens, which, you know, which mirrors real life. You know, sex is just an aspect of adult life. And I think that it's deeply unhealthy that in most parts of the internet, sex has to be hidden and put in a, different corners of the internet, not the normal ones. They have to be hidden in the dark. And, you know, and yeah, so as a result, you know, it is a topic I'd quite like to talk about more. But even in terms of policy and stuff, you know, we've seen a lot of stuff about choking recently and kind of like the kind of policy changes around the rough sex defence, etc. But yeah, I just didn't really do it on Young Vulgarian because I was just like, no, I am a lady. I am a lady on the internet, and it will not end well for me if I, yeah, if I tweet anything that implies in any way, you know, that I have taken my clothes off in front of someone else at any point in my life.
Well, it's just nuance, those conversations, and social media just isn't the place for that, because we have such a black and white view on sex as a topic anyway. And it's like, it just, like, you know, the upskirting thing, like all I was talking about was being upskirted for 2 years, and most of my DMs were like, did you soil your knickers before it happened? I'm hard. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that, and you're talking about being sexually assaulted. So, like, there's clearly not a place for any.
You haven't told me that.
Nuance.
Did you not tell me that because you thought I'd have a panic attack?
Yeah, I can't. Imagine if I told you everyone I'd got. We'd never stop.
Thank you so much, Marie. That was really fun. And
we loved having you on.
I love that you've reintroduced Tumblr. Tumblr is back.
Yes.
I love that. Please do follow Marie, and it's at Young Vulgarian on Twitter. Yes. Are you on Instagram? You're on Instagram, aren't you? Is it at Young Vulgarian
as
well?
It is also at Young Vulgarian, yeah. And my Tumblr is Young Vulgarian, so I've not used it in a bit.
Great brand.
Also, you should definitely buy her book, Haven't You Heard? Gossip, Politics and Power. If you haven't, I've just bought it, so you should buy it too.
Yeah, paperback coming out in September.
Woo! Please do follow us at MikeDeleteLaterPod on Instagram and at MikeDeletePod on Twitter, and email us any guests you'd like to see on the podcast, MikeDeleteLaterPod@gmail.com. Look, also, maybe subscribe. Maybe give us a lovely review. That would be nice.
And remember, social media can be funny and silly, and it can be Tumblr.
But it can also be a lot of people screaming at you for a fun joke.
But however you feel about it, if it starts making you feel bad, you can always just delete everything later.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.